you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and it's October, and that means, once again, our pal, Ryan Daly, is here. Hi, Ryan.
Keeping it spooky.
That's right. Yeah, not so much this time. Of course, yes, for those of you who have been listening to the show, Ryan is always here in October to cover a horror-themed Treasury with me. But unfortunately, we've already done the two DC ones, the Ghosts and House of Mystery. And I will say, unfortunately, when it comes to the fact that Marvel never did a horror-themed anthology. I mean, with all their monster characters, they really could have done a great collection of horror stories, but they never did.
I'm trying to think of a word that's more bigger than shameful, but it's terrible. I mean, can you imagine, like, Tomb of Dracula, Gene Colan's work,
oh,
one up at the size, or Mike
Morbius,
Luke, a man
and,
thing, or something
yeah,
like
Werewolf
that.
Werewolf by Night?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It would have been so cool. Yeah, I can't believe. I mean, I guess, you know, it was all based on sales, but it's a darn shame they never did that. So there weren't, and there are some other minor horror-related treasuries out there, but none of them really felt right. So we decided to go with something else that is date-specific. Specifically, DC Special Series number 27, which is the Batman versus the Incredible Hulk Treasury Edition by Len Wein and Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise his name.
This will be the one time we say it because we're going to be saying his name a lot in this episode. I don't want to keep getting bogged down with that, so that counts for the rest of the episode. But Ryan, why? What's so special about the date related to this comic? Why you wanted to talk about it?
As I discovered only maybe a year or two ago, this Treasury Edition was released on September 24th, 1981. I also was released on that day. This came out on the day of my birth. And I never had it, but when I started getting interested in these treasuries, coinciding with you starting this podcast, this one was always difficult to find because it's such a gem. It's one that I doubt anybody who ever had it wanted to part with it. So if you find it, it'd be pretty expensive, but, generously gifted me a copy for my birthday, and we are also recording this just a few days after my birthday too. So, there's Superman and Spider-Man. That's great. But I mean, like, Hulk and Batman, these are like some of my first loves for these characters. I mean, Batman has always been my favorite DC hero, and the Hulk is like top three, you know, for Marvel. I mean, that you couldn't get bigger. And these were some of the first characters I ever knew who they were. So to find this thing with this creative team, I mean,
oh man, yeah.
I mean, we're listeners, brace yourself. There's going to be a lot of praise heaped on this one coming up.
Yeah, I mean, everyone thinks of Superman versus Spider-Man, especially the first one, as sort of the preeminent Marvel DC team up because it was the first, and it truly is a great book.
Oh, sure,
I mean,
absolutely.
It really, really is a great book. But this one really gives it a run for its money, and we'll get into the details of it all. And all props to Len Wein, who wrote it, for making a team up of two completely unrelated characters work. Because you would think that naturally, like, Batman and Captain America would be kind of more of a – make more sense.
Sure.
as a team-up pair. But, of course, DC and Marvel were trying to sell these books as best as possible. And the Hulk was – Batman was always Batman. And the Hulk was a TV star. Mm-hmm. And Captain America was not. So that was really the whole idea behind it, was like you know, we're going to each pair up our biggest characters and for these treasury editions, and that's what they did.
And I got to tell you, for my sensibilities, I prefer this type of team up. I like it when Batman teams up with somebody who's not just like him. You know, it would be easy, you would think, you know, partnering him with somebody more of his level, more street level. It's like, it's Batman and Moon Knight. Okay, how is that different than just two Batman or two Moon Knight? You know, Batman Captain America is not that much different. But, you know, you see Batman and somebody who's completely different. You throw, like, a magic character. Batman and Doctor Strange. Batman and the Hulk. You know, Batman and Adam Warlock. Throw him in with somebody who's crazy and really out of his own. Those are the type of, like, Brave and the Bold style, like, team-up stories that I like. When you get two characters that are vastly different, because then they have a way of playing off of each other.
Batman and Adam Warlock, their mind reels at the possibility.
Right, yeah. Actually, I mean, no kidding, Batman and Superman, that's the thing that I do like about when they are together, because they accentuate their differences and you really get to see how each one of them shines.
That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, obviously they later on did do a Batman Captain America book, but as a regular book, and that's a great story. But you're right. Yeah, there is the novelty of how the hell is this going to work of these two characters together? And as we'll see very shortly, it worked very, very well. You mentioned that this came out on September 24th, 1981. I mentioned it's DC Special Series number 27, and I've mentioned this in previous episodes. DC Special Series was DC's grab bag title. Whatever, because back then, postal regulations, like, to actually, like, I think, register a new book was expensive. Like, it actually cost money to do that. And so that's why nowadays, they, you know, with books starting over number one for any reason at all. But back in the olden days, they didn't do that. They would constantly change titles for books and keep the numbering because there was lots of sort of financial reasons to do it. DC Special Series, during its 27 issues, was an 80-page giant book. It was a regular-sized comic. It was a digest. It was a treasury. Whatever DC needed it to be, it was. which is amazing, because there's only a couple issues earlier, it was a digest. This is the last – not only is this the last issue of DC Special Series, it is the last classic DC Treasury. Ooh. They did not publish another Treasury for 18 years until they started doing the Paul Dini, Alex Ross books in 1998.
Sure. Okay. Wow. I didn't realize that. Wow.
Yeah. This is it. You really killed the Treasuries, Ryan. I hope you're happy with yourself.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well, I'm sure that's something else my brother will blame my birth on.
There you go. This was reprinted in 1996 as a regular sized comic. It was as a sort of a one-off commemorative edition, and said we'll get into it, and you'll be able to see some of the pages on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com, because as JLGL said and later on in an interview, he really loved doing a book in the Treasury format because you could, as he said, you could see everything.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, howdy can you, because this thing is so beautiful to look at. So let's get right to it. This is a big story. The cover. Well, first, let's talk about the cover before we even get to the story. It says DC and Marvel present Batman versus the Incredible Hulk, the blazing battle you never expected to see. Batman is swinging in and he's throwing a batarang at the Hulk. I'm not sure what he expects that to do. The Hulk is picking up a giant piece of machinery and he's about to throw it at the Hulk. Meanwhile, in the background, the Joker is saying ta-ta to the whole situation. It says also featuring the vile villainy of the Joker and the Shaper of Worlds. Again, another bizarre team up. So, what do you think of this cover?
It's so gorgeous. I mean, it's just really, really good. Just getting it out there, just talking about Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name,
ad infinitum. Right, we're done. We mean it. We're done. Yeah,
just mentally add that, declarative at the end of it. When I close my eyes, he's how I envision these characters. Like, he, mm-hmm. it's like, I mean, there's a reason for his style guide and everything, but
yes,
you just think about, like, this is them on model. This is the way, like, he distills sort of the purest sort of essence, and he gets just like what superheroes are supposed to look like. So when I think of Batman, this is the version. When I think of Superman, I think of his version. Now, I gotta say, just like looking at his Hulk, and, you know, for somebody who didn't, with like one or two really minor exceptions, never worked for Marvel.
Nope.
But I guess, like, his version of the Hulk may be my favorite version.
It's
like
the Hulk.
It's like, I mean, it's a perfect little blend of Herb Trimpe and Sal Buscema, and it just sort of, like, gets to, it's like, yes, this is perfect. That is what the Hulk looks like. And, like, yeah, I mean, my kid recognized it. He saw me reading this, and he pointed to it, and he doesn't know anything, but he recognized that, and he was like, oh, he knew who the Hulk was because he's seen him on, like, other toys and merchandise that I try to get him to pay attention to. And then, yeah, just, like, seeing the Joker lifting his hat in the background, just kind of, like, laughing as he thinks this is hilarious. It's action-packed. There's a ton of text, but it doesn't feel crowded. Can we talk about the evolution of this cover?
Yeah, oh, sure, yeah, because on the inside back cover, they provide four sketches of the cover and editorial notes as they were sort of commenting on JLGL's various versions of the cover.
Can you imagine being the person who gives notes to Jose Luis García López?
No, like, that's ridiculous.
I mean, obviously these guys were contemporaries and they were peers and they had different working relationships, but, like, Dick Giordano and Al Milgrom, like, I could never be the person who just says, yeah, Jose, you drew the Hulk's feet wrong. You got to fix that.
Yeah, no, I can't. This, you know what this reminds me of? And this will tie in perfectly to one of your shows, Cheerscast. Mm-hmm. Presumably you've heard the story that at some point Kurt Vonnegut offered to write an episode of Cheers.
Wow, a long time ago I did hear that, yeah.
Okay, right now, okay. Now, but he never did. Mm-mm. And I read at some point along the line that the offer was not taken up, that the writers of Cheers were told that he was interested and they never took him up on it. And of course, if you're an outsider, when I heard that, I'm like, that's crazy. Why wouldn't they do that? That's nuts. Why Kurt Vonnegut to write an episode of Cheers? And then many years later on his website, Ken Levine, who was one of the Cheers writers, one of the staff writers, explained why. And he said they were pretty sure that Kurt Vonnegut had no idea how to write a half hour of television, and they were not going to be the ones to rewrite Kurt Vonnegut. And when you hear, like, when you hear it put like that, you're like, that makes total sense. Because these guys are just, like, you know, in their own mind, sitcom writers. We're not going to rewrite the guy that wrote Slaughterhouse-Five.
Right.
So that's what it makes me think of, like, being an editor and having to – I mean, Len Wein couldn't draw by his own admission, although he did do a Who's Who listing. But, I mean, imagine being – yeah, having the job and saying, Jose, redraw this. What? Like, what, are you crazy?
You want to take another pass at this? I don't feel like this is your best work.
Yeah, this is not your best work. What the hell? Like, you know – I mean, if you look at the sketches – I kind of see their point. Like, I get that the Hulk's foot looks a little dainty, and on that first sketch, Batman swinging into the way he's swinging in is a little awkward. But just still, I just, to me, it's like I see anything by him, and I'm just like, oh, that's perfect. Let's run with it. It's ready to go.
I'd kill to have any of those sketches originally, though. But
yeah. So, and I love that they provided that as a little bonus on the inside. I think that on the inside back cover. So yeah, it's a really marvelous cover. It's beautifully colored. I mean, the Hulk's look sort of beautiful, like emerald green sort of thing. And again, I love that you mentioned the Joker is tipping his hat, doing a lot of ta-ta, kind of like a real dick kind of move. And you even see two of his henchmen carrying this machine, which is even kind of getting part of the plot in. And then on the inside cover, we have this very helpful little diagram, these two strips that are just giving bullet point origins of both our characters. And again, this is something that these books were sold not only in comic stores and in newsstands, but they were sold in department stores and supermarkets. Mm-hmm. And they were considered, because of their higher price point, they were considered a higher profit item. And so more stores carried them than your typical 50-cent comic book. So they were figuring that, you know, kids that were not normally buying Batman and the Hulk would maybe pick this up. And here it is. Like, for those of you unfamiliar with these characters other than the broad strokes, here's the origins. And these feel like something that you would have seen in like a candy giveaway, or just these little strips of just – they tell the whole story in like six panels for each character.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I really like that. And I like the little stock art poses down at the bottom. You've got Batman on the rooftop and the Hulk there. I love them. I love how simple they are. You know, mm-hmm. It's just boom, 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 boom. The Hulk, Batman, you're like, all right, we're ready to go. I understand everything. We're ready. And I even like how Jose matches the design for each one. Like on the Batman thing, you've got this little strip going across of like the seven heads that shows about how he can change. He's a master of disguise. And then on the Hulk version, you've got five little insets of him metamorphosing into the Hulk.
Right.
So I just like that he matches the design for each one too. It's really simple, but really beautiful.
And those, I mean, those will play into this particular story, you know, with especially mm-hmm. with Batman, you know, going undercover and having to like disguise yep. himself. I mean, that's a plot point a couple times during the story. So, like, it's nice to remind the readers. Oh yeah, this is something that's definitely within his wheelhouse.
Yeah, this guy knows how to do that. Even though you've never seen him do it in a movie, he does know how to do that. So, all right, well, let's get to the story. It's called The Monster and the Madman by Len Wein, as we said, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, Dick Giordano, inker, John Costanza, letterer, Glennis Wein, colorist, Al Milgram and Jim Shooter, consulting editors, with special thanks to Marv Wolfman and Mike DiCarlo for their help, whatever the hell that means. So it opens up with a prologue in Gotham City. A man desperately tries to sleep during a sweltering summer evening. Finally drifting off, he dreams of being in the Arctic. He then awakens to find his bed, actually his whole apartment, covered in ice and snow. Across town, two teenagers are making out in the dark confines of a movie theater as a monster movie plays on the screen. Suddenly, the two lovers find themselves surrounded by all sorts of nightmarish creatures. Meanwhile, in an abandoned warehouse across town, the Joker and some of his goons are talking with an unseen partner. This disembodied voice begs the Clown Prince of Crime to obtain a valuable object for him, which Joker says he will. After the Joker hears one of his henchmen ever so slightly mocking his boss, the Joker hands him a boutonniere from his lapel. A thorn pricks the goon's finger, leading to a painful and quick death from poisoning.
Chapter 1, When Wakes the Behemoth. Bruce Banner is working as workman at Wayne Research, hoping to get in proximity to a new device the company is working on called the Gamma Gun. Suddenly, all of the employees in the lab start laughing uncontrollably, leading Banner to put on a radiation suit to protect himself. The Joker and his gang arrive and attack Banner as he tries to sound the alarm, triggering his transformation into the Hulk. The goons grab the gun and make it outside, only to see the Batman is waiting for them. A few well-placed kicks send the gun hurtling in the air, where the Hulk catches it. The Joker is worried the monster will damage the device, and before Batman can react, the Harlequin of Hate manipulates the Hulk into seeing Batman as his enemy. While the Joker watches with glee, Batman fights for his life against the Hulk. He only survives by releasing some knockout gas and then kicking the Hulk in the stomach, forcing him to breathe it in. The Joker escapes, and shortly thereafter, Bruce Wayne arrives at Wayne Research to offer Bruce Banner a job, explaining who knows more about Gamma Research than him.
Chapter 2, When Dreams Won't Come. Back at the warehouse, the Joker fires up the Gamma Gun at its intended target. We see that the Joker's partner in crime is none other than the Shaper of Worlds. The Shaper explains that thanks to a trip through a supernova, he has lost the ability to absorb the dreams of others, which is slowly driving him mad. Now stranded on Earth, the Shaper has been searching through people's subconsciousness, finding nothing of use or value until he discovered the Joker, a mind unique in all the universe. One of the Joker's goons asks him why he's helping the Shaper, and he explains that if the Shaper goes mad, so will the entire planet, rendering the Joker ordinary. He can't live with that. Unfortunately, the Gamma Gun doesn't do the job the Shaper wanted.
Chapter 3, When the Sea Churns Green. On a supertanker out at sea, Bruce Banner and a team of scientists continue their work. After losing his temper at a fellow scientist, Alfred Pennyworth offers the tense Banner a cup of tea. Banner wonders where Wayne is, and Alfred says he's busy. Of course, we see that he means Batman is out looking for info on the Joker's whereabouts, roughing up some lowlifes in the process. After finding a clue in the form of a matchbook, Batman heads for the Black Swan Cafe. In disguise as a drunk beggar, Batman overhears some other denizens of the bar discuss the Joker's plans. Pulling off his disguise, he heads out. Back on the tanker, some men dressed as Army Intelligence arrive unexpectedly to arrest Bruce Banner. When Alfred objects, he gets a punch in the face. Now revealed as phonies, Banner turns into the Hulk. Wishing there was someone else there to fight the Hulk, one of the Joker's goons finds his thoughts turned into reality when a massive, doughy creature suddenly appears and engages in a battle with the green-skinned Goliath. The being can change its shape and grow so large it envelops the Hulk into its stomach, creating a cage that even he cannot escape from. The men take off in their chopper, leaving Alfred to watch. Soon after, Batman arrives along with Commissioner Gordon. Gordon calls General Thunderbolt Ross, who confirms that no army operation of any sort has been launched into Gotham in the last 24 hours.
Chapter 4, When the Shaper Commands. The Joker tells the Shaper that once the Hulk turns back into Banner, he can help adjust the Gamma Gun so it does what the Shaper needs it to do. But the Hulk gets so mad at the thought of turning back into puny Banner that he bursts out of the monster's stomach and attacks the Shaper. Unfortunately, the Shaper's madness then kicks in, causing the Hulk to have to smash through a parade of nightmarish illusions. But instead of making him angrier, this mollifies the Hulk for a moment until he finds himself standing in front of the Shaper, quiet. The Joker is baffled, and the Hulk escapes. The Shaper now understands that it's not the gun that will help him, it's the Hulk himself. He demands the Joker bring the Hulk back to him, a task even someone as nuts as the Joker finds daunting. Later, the Batman sees the bat signal in the sky. He finds the source of the beam is the Joker. He explains why they need him to team up to find the Hulk, and the unlikely partners go on a search for the missing monster. They eventually find the Hulk, and when Batman gives chase, this leads to another fight. Batman is temporarily stopped by some falling debris, and the Hulk takes off yet again. Later, the Hulk is befriended by a blind man, whose gentle friendship calms the Hulk, allowing him to be talked into going off with the Joker. Of course, the blind man in the alley is actually Batman in disguise again.
Chapter 5, When Madness Reigns. Batman insists on going in to see the Shaper with the Hulk, refusing to let him face the danger alone. As they get closer, they see imaginary versions of many of their old foes, like Two-Face, the Rhino, the Leader, and the Scarecrow. When struck, these villains burst into atoms, and our heroes keep advancing. Finally, they approach the Shaper, who is surrounded by a force field. Batman realizes the only way through it is to tell the Hulk that it is stronger than he is, which, of course, makes the Hulk even more powerful. After destroying the field, the Hulk collapses and turns back into Banner. But the battle is not over. Batman then learns what the Joker's role in all of this was, the promise of unlimited power. Now unconstrained by reality, Joker declares himself king of the world, warping the world into his sick visions. Batman and Hulk give chase, and even a roundhouse punch from the Hulk doesn't do any harm, now that the Joker has turned the Hulk's hands into harmless bot bags. The Batman, now decked out as a clown, declares he is disappointed in his old foe. Tweaking the Joker's vanity, Batman pushes and pushes until the Joker's mind starts to strain under the weight of coming up with more and more outlandish scenarios to make real. Finally, the Joker relents and is punched out by Batman once again, where he lands in the arms of the Hulk. The Shaper, watching from afar, gets back in his ship and leaves the Earth.
Epilogue. Back at Arkham Asylum, the Joker is wrapped up in a straitjacket, having lost even the slightest touch with reality. With the Shaper gone, Gordon turns his attention to Banner, but Batman requests that Gordon let him go. Looking out a window at Banner departing, Batman remarks that they are lucky enough to have dreams, while Bruce Banner's life is a living nightmare. So, I really tried to write the shortest synopsis I could, and it was still that long. But, I, you know, Ryan, you're the guest. Where do you want to start with this thing? There's so much to discuss, but I will let you – where do you want to go? Where do you want to start?
So I will start with a very big picture because it's a very big comic. Ha-ha. No. As I was reading this, with these characters, Batman and the Hulk, literally never looking better – in an adventure that feels big, that feels fun, that feels crazy and far out, but just so sort of perfect for these big mainstream, like popular heroes. The comparison that I kept coming back to is this story reminds me of the golden age of Steven Spielberg in Hollywood. Like, think of Spielberg's career from 1975 until 1993. Like, that was the pinnacle of Hollywood. That was what you wanted to see from everything. You wanted movies that looked as good and as spectacular as that, that had characters that were as memorable and heartfelt as that, that had dialogue that was as smart and as funny as that, and that just made you – it was transformative. It was transcendent. You know, that type of Hollywood movie making. I'm talking about the Indiana Jones movies, Jaws, Close Encounters, all the way up through Jurassic Park, Schindler's List, everything. This story, reading that, felt like that type of storytelling. Just like firing on all cylinders. This is the gold standard. This is as good as it gets. It's just, yeah, it's incredible. It's so good. And, yeah, I mean, and the story is not without flaws, but who cares when it looks and feels as fun as this does?
Yeah, I mean, Lynn Wein and like Jerry Conway before him, who did Superman vs. Spider-Man, they knew to rise to the occasion. They knew they had to tell a big story for this presentation. I mean, if you're going to go all out and you're going to get JLGL to draw it, for Pete's sakes, you really want to deliver for what kids are paying back then, $2.50, the exorbitant amount of $2.50 for this book. And it does feel like that. It feels like a big budget live action kind of thing of Batman versus the Hulk. I would say, I think probably one of the more difficult things to do when writing these crossover team ups, not that I've ever obviously done such a thing, but it would be to balance out the characters. And I would say, and this is not meant as a criticism, just an observation, that this feels a little more like a Batman comic that the Hulk is in, not so much a 50-50 split. Batman is really kind of driving the story. The Joker, the Shaper of Worlds, just by the fact that he's just sitting there. He doesn't get to move around for the most part, other than the flashback where you see him going through space. He's kind of, he's just tucked off in this warehouse. But by the way, the Gotham City really has to close down all abandoned warehouses. They just have to stop that. I mean, the minute some company folds and leaves their warehouse abandoned, they just need to raise it, because it's, you know, the Joker's going to be there, or if not Joker, the Penguin at the very least. I mean, come on. But it's the broken window theory. But it's like Wein wrote both characters in his history, which is part of the reason that he was tapped for this, is that he knew both characters. But I think he had always said that Batman was his favorite, and I think you can feel that, because I feel like it has all the Batman stuff in it. It's got the bat signal. He uses disguises. It's got Commissioner Gordon. It's got all – and of course, it all takes place in Gotham City on top of it. It's got Alfred in it. I mean, they also work in Thunderbolt Ross, even Doc Samson, who I didn't even mention in the synopsis.
Glorified cameos, yeah.
Glorified cameo for Doc Samson. But, I mean, this feels a little more like a Batman story. Again, that's not a criticism. It's just an observation that Batman is kind of the driver of this. And at the same time, one of the things that people have commented about this book are the fight scenes, is that the idea that Batman could last even 5 seconds against the Hulk is maybe pushing it a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first, to the point that I agree with you that I think this is mostly a Batman story, but it's not like 70% to 30%, you know. It's close. It's, you know, 55-60% Batman. But I also think it was technically a DC publication.
That's true.
A joint venture with Marvel, but it was DC's really editorial team and their guys working on this.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, I mean, yes, should the Hulk be able to just like stomp all over Batman? Yes, Batman is only human, but Batman has trained, and I think this is also a point in their histories where it was possible that the Hulk could take a beating. You know, there were other beings that were more popular. Batman wasn't the invincible super god that he is now. You know, he's afraid. He's terrified throughout the fights. You know, he's just barely hanging on. And he gets lucky a few times. And he really only beats him once their first fight, when he's able to knock him out just by, like, making the Hulk inhale the gas. After that, the Hulk learns from that mistake and basically uses Batman and just swings him around in order to get rid of, to disperse the gas. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, they shouldn't. If they were fighting to the death, you know that this wouldn't go the same way. But they're both heroes, and you know what's going to happen. So I think it was okay. Yeah.
And it's an interesting idea in that it's a Batman even says in the point where he releases the gas pellets, and Hulk is actually smart enough to be like, Hulk, not breathe in funny gas. And Batman even has an observation of like, okay, he's not that stupid. He knows not to breathe in the gas. So Hulk takes in a deep, he goes like, does like a big deep breath. And Batman says, even in the dialogue, he's like, I have to make this count. Like, this has to be basically like the kick of his lifetime. And you think about that, Batman, for the most part, doesn't fight superpowered foes. He fights regular people. So I wonder, with Batman as much of an Olympic level athlete that he is, I wonder how lethal would a kick from Batman who's not holding back be? Like, if Batman kicked a normal human with all of his might, would that just kill you? It probably would.
I mean, so I'm sure a Batman kick would probably break most people's ribs and, you know, could puncture along. It would be serious.
Right. So maybe Batman really could do that kind of damage to the Hulk. It's possible. I do want to wind back to the very beginning a little bit. First of all, I love the splash page of the color hold of the shape of the world's in the background and Batman and Hulk leaping at each other. I love the prologue of the guy who's trying to sleep and it's so hot and he wakes up and it's, you know, they're snowing in his apartment. But I really want to mention the second page where the couple are making out at the movie theater and they're at a midnight movie marathon, which is great. And then the girl opens her eye and she's like, Bobby. And all of a sudden they're surrounded by all these monsters. And I love that all the monsters are distinctive. There's like a giant like lizard and there's like some sort of ape creature that's eating the popcorn. Now the girl is wearing an outfit I've never seen any human wear. She is in a yellow. She looks a little like a waitress from like a 50s diner. Mm-hmm. She's got this yellow blouse. She's got suspenders, red tights, and cowboy boots. It is no outfit I've ever seen any human ever wear, but I'm totally down for it.
And her hair is like pulled back in like a bow or something like that. Like she looks like a girl from the 50s or something like that. But yeah, the cowboy boots, it's a weird look. Now, yeah,
I'm on board. I'm totally on board with this. Yeah. I wish women looked like this in the real world, Jose. So wherever he got this idea from, more power to him.
That panel, though, like this whole page, but that panel in particular right there, like this is why we could do this in the month of October. Because, like, this is a mini cover to Tales of the Unexpected or House of Secrets or something.
Yes.
Like, this is like classic campy horror DC comic like, right there. Like, these people in the movie theater and they're surrounded by all these monsters that
even the seat has turned into a monster. We see the seat behind them has like a giant eyeball and stuff and is looking at them and stuff. So I just love that bit. And you know, we've talked about, good Lord, we have talked about JLGL in so many different episodes across the network, but just, and he makes every person that he draws so distinctive. We get that shot of the Joker where he's talking about, you know, at the warehouse and he goes, "The Joker always delivers." And he's got these goons behind him and they all are different looking. They all have different body types, facial types. And then the one guy, when the one goon mouths off and Joker hands him the rose and the guy gets, as I mentioned in the synopsis, he gets pricked on the finger by a thorn. And when he like sucks his thumb and he's like, "Boy, that's schmatz. I feel like I'm," and I mean, just, it's so like he just conveys so much emotion with these simple lines. It's just like, man, they could not have gotten a better guy to do this job. It's just so beautiful to look at.
The one thing that I'm not used to, as much as I think Jose's Hulk is maybe my favorite Hulk ever. His Bruce Banner is a little bit bigger than I'm used to seeing. Like he's got a little bit more mass, a little bit more muscle, and maybe that's just kind of like the proportions of the Treasury book. But I'm used to seeing him as a little bit scrawnier, a little bit skimpier. But and maybe that's the influence of, you know, Bill Bixby, who wasn't, you know, a skinny little thing. But who knows?
No. Yeah, I'm sure that some of that had to bleed into the Hulk. And they said when we finally get the debut of the Hulk, I mean, Jose really knows how to, of course, do the layout, because we have these little inset panels as Banner is in the hazmat suit, and then the Hulk's head literally bursts out of the helmet, and then he does that flex, and he does that, and he flips it, he's knocking a bunch of people off, and it's just, oh my, you know, leave Hulk alone, humans, or Hulk will smash. And by the way, we should mention, these stories always exist in a parallel universe where these characters all know each other. The Joker sees the Hulk and he goes, "That's not just any monster, it's the Hulk." So it's like these people are not meeting each other for the first time. This is like the X-Men Teen Titans book. These are characters that have been around each other, you know, for a while.
Yeah, I mean, Batman knows, he recognizes the Hulk. He's like, "Oh, that's, I've heard about him." Like, he knows certain facts about him, and even to the point where he knows it's actually Bruce Banner who transforms into the Hulk.
Right.
Like, he knows that history, yeah. And Batman's debut, like the first page, like where the bottom half where you see him swing into view, kicking two of Joker's goons. And
going somewhere, punk.
Oh, man. It's the Joker can con the Hulk because they both have green hair. Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
that panel where the Joker is talking to the Hulk, and even Batman's like, damn it, I got it, it's too late. And we have this thing where basically the Joker is pointing into the camera, and he's like, just think about it, big fella, and it becomes obvious. Yes. If anyone around here is your enemy, the Hulk, it's him. And the Hulk is looking right in the camera, and I'm like, what a terrifying thought that would have to be, to have the Joker be able to turn the Hulk against you. Like, that is really, really scary. And I love those scenes of Batman punching the Hulk in the ribcage, and he's just like trying to paralyze the Hulk's nerve centers. And then he's like, come on, you big green gorilla, fall. By blazes, won't you fall? And then, of course, the Hulk tries to snap his spine, and Batman starts screaming. He says, my spine, he's going to snap it like a pencil. If I don't move fast, I'll never move again. And the only one that gets him out is that he boxes the Hulk's ears for a second, which buys him just a couple of seconds. So it's JLGL manages to make it just plausible enough that you're like, okay, Batman's not going to last long against the Hulk, but he's, of course, a lot smarter, so that's going to give him the edge he needs.
Right.
So, and I love all the scene at night when he's running around, he's trying to chase the Hulk, and then the Joker with the gamma gun, to me, is just very funny. He's got the headphones on, and he's like, it's fireworks time! He's just letting it rip, and then we get that big splash page of the Shaper of Worlds, and then there's that really cool origin sequence where we're kind of caught up to where the Shaper of Worlds is doing, where Jose redraws one of the same panels of the couple in the movie theater, except the monsters are all different positions. So he's redrawing his own work, but instead of just statting it, he redraws it.
Yeah.
God, the guy was – he really brings it.
He takes that seriously. I do think the Shaper and his kind of plot is the weak point of this story. In terms of just like really the Shaper, like that's who we got in for this one. But what it does do is give the artist Jose in this the opportunity to do some of this stuff, and it really pays off towards the end of the book when you have just like the last, you know, 5 or 6 pages of the Joker's madness taking over the world and really just transforming things. I mean, that's kind of the payoff for using this character, is to give the Joker that kind of godlike power. Because up until that, as I'm reading this, I'm like, okay, it's really entertaining to see the Joker. I'm like, but could this have been almost any Batman villain in this play? I mean, the dialogue would be different. It wouldn't be quite as zany. But I was like, could Penguin or Two-Face or Scarecrow, somebody else, have subbed in this kind of role? But you really, you need kind of like, you need that the end, like that sort of climactic thing, like where what does the world become when this villain gets the power? And it has to be the craziness of the Joker. Because that's ultimately how, as we described, that's how he's undone. Because the Batman just keeps pushing him further and further along until his failure of imagination.
Yeah, when we get to that sequence, I will mention something that's specific to JLGL that I love. By the way, I love when another scene that's great, when Batman breaks into the little warehouse where these goons are. One of them is sitting on a TV, which is clearly stolen, which I love that. But after Batman knocks all these guys out, there's this great, almost full-page panel of Batman, and he's resting his leg on the body of one of the people he's knocked out. It's completely just being, like, you know, undignified for these guys, where he's using them as a step stool, which I just love. I love that whole sequence. And then they go to the Black Swan Cafe, and, you know, I'm not going to get too into, like, oh, my Batman was a lot better than the Batman nowadays. But there's a sequence here in this bar, the Black Swan Cafe that they go to, which is clearly like a hangout for the criminal underworld, right? So Batman is in disguise as a drunk, and he's always in the background going, spare change, and everyone's ignoring him. Until finally, the bartender, who's this big brute-looking dude, throws him out. And he's like, and stay out! I almost see your ugly puss in my place again until you can buy your own drinks, loser! And then the next panel, he's pulling the mask off. Which, by the way, I know you and Chris love remarking about this on Nightcast, that Batman has his mask on under his mask. That's got to be hot as hell. But Batman allows that guy to throw him out.
Mm-hmm.
I think nowadays, angry Batman would go back and like break that guy's legs for just doing that. But instead, this Batman takes the abuse because he's like, you know what? I'm on a mission here. I don't really care about that. He doesn't want to blow his own cover. But I kind of like that Batman is like allows himself for it. There's some guy out there who's like, I threw Batman out of my bar. And they'll never know it, but he did it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a Batman who understands the more gentle touch, who's actually going to like infiltrate these guys and go undercover to get information. Whereas I think post year one, post Dark Knight Rises, I mean, you got like the Batman is just going to like walk in there in full costume and just scare, quote unquote, you know, terrify the group into giving him the information he wants. I think this is a little bit more nuanced, a little bit more interesting, and shows a better, more interesting side of Batman, because it's a side who has to employ his brains because he's not invincible.
Right. Right. I mean, yeah, and he knows he's got what he's got to do to and that plays into the story because he tries to take on the Hulk directly and he realizes it doesn't work, so I got to go another way. I love when the Joker's goons dressed as the army men try and arrest the Hulk, and I love that one. In, there's a little panel of like six guys swarming the Hulk's body, and they're just like ants crawling all over. That's such a great.
I love the scale of that, like how big he is compared to them. Like it's just
I love all that. And then that monster that shows up, the big kind of doughy monster. It's a shame that they couldn't find a way to make that Clayface.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously this is Clayface's. Although, of course, they didn't have this version of Clayface in 1981. They didn't have the version from the animated series. They only had the other version. So you really couldn't have a monster like this. But, I mean, this is such a Clayface kind of thing that he's able to basically just absorb the Hulk into his stomach and turn himself into a cage at the Hulk. Look, let Hulk out, blob thing. Let Hulk go. He's so mad.
The Captain America villain Arnim Zola had a doughboy creature that was kind of similar to this that could do something
right.
like that.
That's right.
They could have incorporated him.
I love the Commissioner Gordon gets a cameo when he calls Thunderbolt Ross. That's kind of a nice thing there. I like that. I like the idea that the Hulk is basically just like a walking gamma bomb himself almost, and that the Shapers realize, no, I just need the Hulk himself. I don't need the gun. I just need the Hulk himself. That'll work. And then we get that brief Batman Joker team up, which of course reminds you all of all those Brave and Bolds that Bob Haney wrote, where Batman had to actually team up with the Joker. I love it when the Joker reaches out to shake his hand, and Batman's like, "Forget it. I only said I'd work with you. I never said I have to like it." And he pulls his cape away, kind of like a petulant little kid. He's like, "I'll do this, but I don't like it, Joker." And then that panel of him, the very next panel of him diving off, where you don't see his face, like that's such a great shot. I can't believe that didn't make it into stock art. I think it's such a great pose of him just sort of jumping out into the camera and stuff. And then we get all these I love them tracking the Hulk. I love when they find the Hulk. The Hulk's just randomly beating people up. This is great.
He's fighting some of the warriors. Yeah.
Hulk, come out and play. Batman's like, Hulk, wait, put those boys down. Put those boys down. These are guys are the criminal underworld. He's put those boys down.
Yeah, like Batman's trying to reason with him. And he's like trying to get his attention. Why don't we just phone him, Bats? It's like, why do we have to get this close?
Yeah, I love
it's
that.
A long distance.
And then they get in this big fight. The Hulk throws a car at Batman.
Yes.
And Batman jumps through one door out the other, which is really fantastic. Only Batman could do that.
Right. That's the moment in the movie where everything slows down. You get the Matrix-style slow motion effect.
Yes.
Where Batman has to leap through the passenger window as the car is traveling towards him and then crash out the driver's side.
Yeah, yeah. So then he appears as the blind man and he mollifies the Hulk there. And then I love the dream sequence where even though they're not really there, it doesn't matter. For one moment, we get to have a panel, just a couple of panel, just a page really. But we get a page where we get to see Two-Face standing next to the Rhino, standing next to the Abomination, standing next to the Leader, standing next to Killer Moth, standing next to Scarecrow, which is like, when else am I ever going to see this in my life?
Because when you think of Batman's All-Star Rogues Gallery, you definitely include Killer Moth.
Yeah. I wonder whose idea that was, whether that was Len Wein inserting a personal favorite or something. But yeah, that's kind of funny. Like the Riddler and Catwoman must have been like, all right. But yeah, I love that. Such a great just again, they're dream sequences, but it doesn't matter. You just get to see them all. And again, as you mentioned, Jose never did any Marvel stuff, really. So this is the only time you're ever going to get to see him draw any of these characters.
Yeah. Just what little we do see of them, the Abomination looks great, even though, I mean, it's small. The Rhino is included just because when you look at, like, Hulk villains, a lot of times they'll import the Rhino or Juggernaut just because they're comparable size. I do like, though, that he includes the Leader, who is my favorite Hulk villain, and that he gives him, like, the murder module machine thing to kind of put him on equal footing, which I really like that. Getting just the page before, like, getting back to, like, the blind man, I mean, I don't know if he's supposed to be reminiscent. To me, he kind of he sort of vaguely looks Stan Lee-ish, and he's got like the white mustache and everything. But I also kind of think of like the sage old wise blind man who kind of befriends the Hulk. It feels like a moment from Frankenstein.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I wonder if Ween was intentionally going for something like that. He probably was, but.
I was going to make espresso.
Gene Hackman version.
A
very large mute.
Don't let it go until the tip glows. So then after the Shaper is sort of dispensed and Joker gets all the power, he turns himself into James Cameron, which is fun because then he becomes like this total Harlequin, and then he takes off. And there's that – we get that – the Hulk takes on the Shaper of Worlds. And then Batman gets turned into literally a clown with the giant clown feet and the makeup on, and he's got his ears are drooping over, and there's bells on the end of his face. And there's this great inset panel where Batman says, in that case, Joker, I'm disappointed in you. And again, he's pointing right at the camera. Jose manages to make Batman still look kind of badass, even though he's got a clown face over his costume. I don't know. I don't know if a lot of people would be able to do that. And I love the Hulk with his striped socks and his bow tie, and he's got his clown makeup on. And I love that Jose just drops all the panel borders for these sequences, and all the images run into one another. I mean, good Lord, the scene where Hulk and Batman are dressed as Tweedledum and Tweedledee, and they're being chased by the royal guards from Alice in Wonderland, and there must be like 30 little figures that he's drawing in there. It's like, God, how long did it take him to do this book?
I wonder how Jervis Tetch feels about the Joker doing a Mad Hatter impression. He's like, dude, stay in your lane.
Yeah, well, come on, Joker. We already know you're the main guy. Do you have to steal everybody's thing? I mean, why don't you start telling Batman riddles, for Pete's sakes?
I'm the Mad Hatter. I have so little. Can you leave me?
Yeah, give me a break. Yeah. Come on. So then they get the nightmare sequence where sort of up is down, where it's very M.C. Escher with the stairwell.
Yeah, yeah.
The stairwell kind of goes into nowhere. And then we turn into kind of like... Yeah, and then it becomes like a Picasso painting where we see – I like the sort of Picasso Batman where he has got no face. Anything Joker, then prove it. And that drives Joker a little nuts. And then all it takes is a little punch from Batman to just knock him out. And then I love when he lands in the Hulk's arms, and then the Hulk just drops him. He's just like, thunk. He doesn't care about this guy at all. Bah, stupid white face thought he could beat Hulk. Yeah, that's great. And then the Shaper, who's watching all this, is like, yeah, I'm out of here. And he just gets in his ship and takes off.
So I gave him what he wanted. Now it's on him. So
yeah, what do you want me to do? And then it ends, like we mentioned, with the Hulk, with the Joker, as they say, even more mad than ever before. Now, of course, these stories exist outside of continuity, so we never really saw this version of any of these characters ever again. It wasn't like the next story had the Joker suffering from this torment, because this is a different Joker than any of the version we saw. And then the final panel, I mean, dang it, just cue up the Hulk sad theme music. Yeah. I mean, it's the perfect. Yeah. And I am intrigued, though, by the button where it says the end for now. What does that mean? What does that mean? They're going to like maybe do another one of these? I mean, they never did, but you know, don't tease me like that, Len Wein. Come on.
Yeah, that would have been great. I mean, certainly would have liked to see more, but
yeah, they did a Superman Spider-Man sequel. Why couldn't they have done a sequel to this? I mean, I've never learned how any of these things sold. So, I mean, I presumably it didn't do well enough for them to keep doing it. And then the very last thing is the back cover, which we haven't gotten to, which is another Donnybrook shot of all the villains. And I love that Jose is mixing the fights. Like, we're seeing Batman kick the leader.
Yeah.
We're seeing the Hulk throw Killer Moth. I mean, just that is fun. And I love this sort of very stylized cityscape in the background.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
the silhouette in front of the moon. It's just... Oh, man. He's like, this thing just from top to bottom is just gorgeous.
It's God, it's such a beautiful image. Like, just turn this into a poster and just, like, blow it out. It's so good. But, yeah, like, the fact that the two guys, they're fighting all of the villains. They're managing to make contact with all of them. There's, like, no wasted thing here. Like, Batman is managing to punch Two-Face in the face, kick Scarecrow in the face, and with his other foot, kick the leader, like, through the window, the windshield of the murder module. While just slightly behind him, the Hulk he's lifted up the abomination. Okay, so that's a very much smaller abomination, but he's like lifting him up by the throat while he's tossing the Killer Moth, Right the Rhino. Oh, actually, that goes back to something that I wanted to mention. Back on page 54, it's when they're fighting these same guys, like the dream hallucination versions of them. Like when Batman is like throwing Killer Moth with his rope right in the Rhino. Like, if these were the real characters, that really looks like the Rhino would impale, like, the Killer Moth. Like, his horn would be going through that guy's neck.
Yeah.
It's just because they're not real that Batman is like, yeah, we don't have to put on the gentle gloves with these guys.
Yeah, the Rhino's horn here is like a spike. It's not, when Herb Trimpe would draw it, it's definitely a pointy thing because that's what rhinos have, but it's much more, it's duller and thicker and wider. But here, this looks like he would just be stabbed through the chest.
Yeah.
The Killer Moth. Not that that would be some great loss to the Batman canon, but nevertheless.
Hey, that's Batgirl's archenemy.
That's a good point. I do like when Hulk punches Scarecrow, he turns into straw, yes, which is funny. He bursts into straw, which is great. And the Batman punches Two-Face right in the crack where their faces yeah, split. And so he turns into two different things. And there's even like a weird, just random, like the Abomination turns into lizards. Mm-hmm. And we see like lizards running in all directions. Again, just the visual imagination that JLGL brought to like every single panel is just unreal. And again, I would love to know how long it took him to draw this. Like, what kind of lead time did they need for him to put this book together? Because, I mean, this is, you know, 64 pages. And not just pages with a ton of characters and all this stuff going on. I mean, I know that these books didn't have, like, a year-long lead time. But you just wonder, how fast could he crank out these pages, and at this level of quality, I mean, of course, yeah, he didn't ink it. Dick Giordano inked it. Even then, just inking 64 pages takes forever. And meanwhile, you know, Dick Giordano had a job at DC Comics. He had like a full time job. Like, when did he have time to do all this stuff?
I don't know. It's incredible.
It really is a magnificent book. It's if DC had to end their treasuries, they didn't have to, but they did. As I think, as collectors became more and more part of the market, and they just were like, I don't like these big books. I can't keep them mint. You know, if you got to go out, you go out with a winner. I mean, of course, they would do X-Men Teen Titans in a year, but that was not a treasury edition. I wish that it were. But I mean, this as a last one, it's a great way to go out because it's enormously fun. It, as you said, these characters look like if you asked a little kid to draw Batman, they would look like this. Not as good, of course, but it would just look like these are what the images you see in your head. Partly is because we all grew up on the merchandise. But as you mentioned, like the thing with the Hulk, every kid that's ever heard of the Hulk would recognize him from these drawings because it's just so iconic the way JLGL does it. So it's just the perfect choice to draw. And it's just a treat to see his stuff this big and get to see all the detail that he threw in. And again, all props to Glennis Wien for doing a great coloring job. This is a beautifully colored book. I mean, everybody's at the top of their game on this one.
Right. Again, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I said, like, you know, this feels like, you know, classic Spielberg in his prime in terms of just like movie making, storytelling, just the visual presentation of this media, like the height of its power. You can get better. Getting right back to what you point out, the end for now, like that sort of like question mark. I'm gonna borrow the secret question from the guys over Secret Wars and Beyond, what Sean Ross and Greg Arujo always do. If they were to continue within this world where you have the blending of the Marvel and the DC, instead of doing a sequel, Batman versus the Incredible Hulk, if Batman was going to interact, like have another story with another Marvel character, let's say not the Hulk and let's say not Captain America, who would you want to see? And the same question for the Hulk. Who would you want to see? Like, where does Bruce Banner go from next after this panel? And who does he interact with from the DC universe?
Oh, boy. All right. All right. Let me start. I'll just finish the sentence here. Let me start with the one that I thought of first. I would like to see, in the notion of that you suggested about pairing up characters that don't have a lot of like, because that makes for more interesting frisson. I'm going to say the Incredible Hulk and Captain Marvel, Shazam. Mm. The idea of two characters that transform into other beings, I think would be interesting. And I would love to see Captain Marvel's innocence paired up against the Hulk's rage. I think that would be, and you could get a real hell of a fight because sure, Captain Marvel could punch the crap out of the Hulk and be able to take it. So I think that would be really interesting to have, like, Billy Batson talking to Bruce Banner about transformations and things like that. So that
if you brought Rick Jones along, too. Like, you could have Rick Jones and Billy Batson, like, friendly.
There you go. Yeah, so that would be my... That's my Hulk. What's yours as I try and think of a good one for Batman?
Part of me, and I don't even know the story or where it would go from this, but I was thinking kind of Wonder Woman, just because I'd like to see her in more Treasury editions.
Yeah.
And just kind of wondering what effect her Lasso of Truth might have had on the Hulk. would it have reduced it? Would it have, like, instantly mellowed him out and like, undone his transformation? Would it have had an effect where he maintains Bruce Banner's intellect while keeping the power of the Hulk? I don't know. Something like that. Green Lantern. Again, somebody that would be kind of like fun and different to John Constantine.
we're a little early for that.
Yeah. A couple years. What about Batman?
That's a good one. I mean, I'm rifling through all the characters, and now that you've brought it up, the idea that these are more interesting if it's a very different character, I'm kind of like, well, no, because then I'd be like, well, Batman and Daredevil would have been really cool, but that's kind of the same thing, or Batman and Moon Knight, and then I'm like, well, Batman and Thor, I'm like, no, that's kind of like, that's just too much of a difference, and Batman and the Fantastic Four, I'm like, no, that doesn't do anything for me either, so right at the moment, I'm coming up dry. But what would be a good Batman and Marvel pairing?
I can see an interesting Batman and Thor story, and partly because there was an animated series that ran back in like 2012-ish, right around the time the Avengers movie came out, called Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes. And the end of the first season had all of the Avengers basically thrown to the different realms of Asgard and kind of like stranded but all separated. And Tony Stark ended up in the realm of the dwarves and the trolls and everything. And he got to use like the Uru metal and everything to make a suit of armor that was like almost like magical, like Mjolnir or something like that. And kind of really see somebody with Tony Stark's mentality and like his style embracing the kind of like magic godliness of like Thor. I think a Batman kind of thrown into that world might be kind of interesting too. I also think, I mean, it's the two mainstream ones, so it's not quite as different, but, you know, Batman and Spider-Man could be fun. Mm-hmm. Although I maintain that during the mid-2000s Brave and the Bold series that was written by Mark Waid and drawn by George Perez, one of the early issues, like issue 3 or something, was Batman teaming up with the Jaime Reyes Blue Beetle. I am convinced that that was Mark Waid writing Batman and Spider-Man.
Okay.
because of the way Jaime Reyes came off, he was like a young, maybe like Ultimate Spider-Man version of like that. Like they had that sort of feel and that dynamic, and I think that was just what he was doing with that. So I've kind of heard that story. But
all right, I'm my head is kind of going to Batman and Iron Man. Mm-hmm. Although that would just be two rich guys talking about their investment portfolio, so maybe that's not the right way to do it. But something like that, yeah. I mean, like you said, Batman, if I'm going to play by the rules and say, well, they need to, it should be like an established Treasury star. Let's just go all the way and do Batman and Howard the Duck. You want to have something to like. I mean, I think would any of us have been able to handle Batman written by Steve Gerber? Like, what would that even look like? I don't even understand.
I can't imagine.
No way DC would let that by. No way.
Batman and Black Widow, like a Batman Shield. I guess like the Amalgam, I think, did something like that. Bruce Wayne, Agent of Shield or something. But
you mentioned Batman and Doctor Strange. That would be kind of fun because that would be Batman completely out of his element.
Yeah.
So that would have something too. But yeah, I mean, and you know, Doctor Strange was a TV star and he did get his own Treasury. So, I mean, it's not even that far afield in terms of like, you know, how weird. I mean, these Treasuries quickly settled into, especially with Marvel, very, very rigid format of basically just Spider-Man Hulk.
Yeah.
It just became every other issue, Spider-Man Hulk. And once in a while we threw in a Conan. But for the most part, it was just they were the things that were selling. And so we just kept doing those forever. But yeah, it's a darn shame that after X-Men Teen Titans, which is a great book, by the way, if any of you have not read that comic, that's a blast. And boy, if that could have been a Treasury. I mean, Walt Simonson artwork? Oh, boy. It's a darn shame that this never – I mean, we all know that JLA Avengers, you know, started to happen and then it collapsed. But that was never going to be a Treasury anyway, which is a darn shame because that would have been amazing to see JLA Avengers as drawn by George Perez in the 80s as a Treasury book. But, you know, like I said, this book always makes me a little wistful because it is the end of the Treasuries and it really is – Marvel kept going with the format, but they were just using it as licensed products. I mean, the Annie adaptation and Smurfs and G.I. Joe. I mean, they were really just kind of – using it as a way to not burn off, but just kind of maximize their license money that they use. But, you know, DC, if you said if you're going to wrap it up, this is a way to do it because this is a hell of a book.
And they got me, you know.
Whatever. Yeah, that's right.
I think it's a good trade.
The world was gifted by two things that day, September 24, 1981. And they probably took about the same time to gestate.
I also think I meant to look this up. I think there was another issue that came out that day was one of the Brave and the Bold issues written by Alan Brennert.
I think
that's good. That's great. But I think it's the one with Hawk and Dove, which not so much a fan of them.
Well, you know, I mean, we can't. I mean, look, even we'll talk about that at some FW Presents in the future someday, because any Alan Brenner comic is good. Maybe some a little not as good as others, but even every one of them is really good. So, yeah, this is a great book. This is just a really phenomenal treasury, and I feel very fortunate I got to gift it for you for your birthday, as you mentioned, because it was like I love sharing these things with people because I'll let everybody know. Back when I started doing the Treasury Comics website, which is unfortunately not around anymore, I was gobbling up treasuries on eBay to, A, fill the holes in my collection, and also, if I was finding them on eBay for a good price, I was buying duplicate copies just to have them. And then I've been able to gift them to people when I have duplicates of things, and I feel very privileged to be able to do that because these books are hard to find kind of nowadays. And, I mean, you know, we were at the Boston Fan Expo, and somebody was selling the friggin' Welcome Back Cotter one for $50. Get the hell out of here. I'm not paying $50 for that. So, you know, I'm very happy that this will be part of your collection and that Reese has already looked at it. Like, that makes me very happy because, you know, when I was a kid – when that wasn't Reese's age, but I was not a whole lot older. These were, and this is why I do the show, because this is my favorite format, because the book is so big. When Reese is old enough to look at this on his own, if you ever let him touch it, because it's so valuable at this point, it'll be like as big as he is.
Oh,
which is super cool. So.
No, and for, yeah, first of all, thank you. Like, definitely like one of the best birthday presents I've ever got. Like, this is, I love having this because this is, I mean, it's just like, in terms of just like the scope and like everything about the presentation, like, this is just like one of those like Hall of Fame all time, just a great comic book story, just because of like the nature of it and what it is and the scope and the spectacle. Everything about this is awesome. But also, yeah, I mean, like, when I was growing up, like, for one thing, again, I mean, this came out the day I was born. So by the time I was getting into comics, I wasn't seeing a lot of treasuries, a lot of magazines. You know, I knew what they were. And I might see them on the wall, but I never thought about buying. And I told this story in like my first appearance on the show, but I never thought about buying those because, for one thing, I didn't know where to put them. I didn't know how to store them. Like, I had my like the few long boxes that I had were like, where do I put this? How do I bag this thing? You know, it didn't feel like that. But once you started talking about these things, like the other formats, and once you started doing these podcasts, when you announced it, I was like, all right, sure. So I got the Star Wars treasuries and the Astonishing Spider-Man treasury and the Steranko history. And I've been picking up a bunch more and things like that. So now I've got about like 10 of these and everything. And I love this show when you cover these. And I've been collecting like just now a lot more of the Marvel black and white magazines. I've got
Savage Fist of Kung Fu too.
Yeah. And it's just, oh, these are so much fun to look at. It never occurred to me to go outside of the box of like the normal size comic book, but I'm having so much fun exploring these things that I just didn't really think about until now. But,
well, that's good. Like I said, they're reset. That's why I love doing the show, because they're just such a great format, and this is one of the best. So Oh, well, awesome, Brian. Thank you for coming back. I am sorry that we kind of don't have any more horror ones to cover, although I do have one idea maybe for next Halloween. We'll have to discuss that at some point. But, no, I was really glad that we got to do kind of like your birthday celebration comic, because this is really – I'll have to use Mike's Amazing World and see if anything really cool came out of my birthday. I mean, of course, back when I was born, comics were only 10 cents. So, I mean, who knows what's out there. But I'll have to look that up.
Even if the comic sucked on your birthday, I mean – you know, for that value.
Yeah, I mean, what the hell, you know, it was only a dime. We were talking about defeating Hitler and stuff, so I mean, it was a very exciting time. So, well, awesome. Well, thank you so much for stopping by again. You know, I always enjoy talking to you. Where can people find you on the internet? I think I know where, but tell them.
Obviously, Facebook and Twitter. You can find me by looking up Ryan Daly. I've obviously a part of this Fire and Water podcast network, which I love being part of. You can find me on Cheerscast, Fire and Water Records, a bunch of other shows. Possibly, I'm not sure when this episode will drop, but possibly the next time you hear me, this Halloween, look for the return of Midnight, the podcasting hour. And not to tip the hat, but the subject matter, we're going to be covering another Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, book.
Name? Ooh, very exciting. All right. That's really cool. I love that show, and I'm glad it's coming back for Halloween, at the very least, back for Halloween. So, all right, well, that's going to be it for this particular comic. I want everybody to stay tuned, of course. I'm going to pay some podcast promos, and when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
The Long Halloween. Hush. Dark Knight Returns. The Killing Joke.
These are all Batman stories that have been talked about and talked about countless times over the years.
They are considered classics, and in most cases, that title is fitting.
The thing is, Batman is nearly 8 decades old, and whilst those stories are worth talking about, there are plenty of other Bat comics that are being a tad overlooked.
And that's where we come in. Hi everybody, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Andrew Leyland.
Andy and I decided that it was a crime that there were so many great Batman stories out there that weren't getting their due.
To that end, we started a show, the Overlooked Dark Knight, a non-index index show.
Our goal is to talk about the previously mentioned overlooked stories and tell you why they're worth your time.
The show comes out twice a month, with the first episode focusing on the Bat books from the late 70s and early 80s. We're starting with the Len Wein run and working our way forward through the books written by Jerry Conway and eventually Doug Mensch.
On the second episode of the month, we'll dig into the various adventure comics that were based on the Fox Kids/Kids WB Batman animated shows, because they're really good and hardly anyone seems to remember that they exist.
The show can be found at the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network, which is located at www.fortressofbaileytude.com.
The Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show.
Shining a bat signal on the bat stories that no one seems to remember or care about.
Because somebody has to.
Fetid swamps to creepy castles, the Podcasting Hour is your home for horror on the Fire and Water Network. Join me, PJ Frightful, on this quarterly anthology podcast that gazes into the mysterious and terrifying shadows of DC Comics. The moon is full and the bell tolls for midnight, the Podcasting Hour.
And we're back with listener feedback, and this is the feedback we got for episode 39 of the show, where I talked about the Transformers IDW Treasury with Derek William Crabb. Treasuries, mother effa, do you read them? Anyway, we got comments on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. The first comment is from Sean Corey, where he says, "Oh, you better believe I'm going to listen to this one." Okay, cool, Sean. Thank you. Gothos Mansion says, to Rob's remark in the comment section about the unseen middle comic in a three-pack, those were crapshoots, and that is how I wound up with a copy of US 1 number 2 in my collection. I know one of the visible comics was a Hulk, and I think the other was an Avengers, but I have a bit of a nerd embarrassment that I have an issue of US 1. The middle comic is also the reason I have a copy of Invader 17, my introduction to Captain America. I can promise you there was no way my mother would have bought that issue for a five-year-old Gothos Mansion if she had seen the cover, and Gothos provides the link to Mike's Amazing World, and yes, it features kind of a Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS sort of woman on the cover, so I could see how that probably wouldn't have passed muster with mothers of the times. Do want to do some episode of FW Presents on that topic at some point, but just requires a lot of research. I haven't gotten around to it yet. Anyway, we got a comment from Edo Bosnar. He says, interesting comments about the mysterious third issue in those three packs, which I've seen elsewhere in the online comic sphere. I have to say, I soon learned how to stretch the plastic a bit without tearing it. Got caught once by the clerk in a joke store while trying to open one to be able to see at least which title was in the middle, if not the actual issue. Yeah, I did that all the time myself. Mark Baker Wright steers us back to talking about Transformers, where he says, well, let's get the elephant out of the room first. I'm definitely on record as not being a fan of Livio Ramondelli's Transformers work, and I honestly don't think it's because I'm a member of a wretched hive of scum and villainy, although I can't really argue against that description of certain parts of the Transformers fandom. I don't mean to argue again Rob or Derek's taste, and indeed think some of his covers are perfectly fine. The problem, in my humble opinion, is more with his work within the stories themselves. Much like Rob suggested for other modern Transformers issues he's seen in the past, although probably for different reasons, I find it extremely difficult to tell what's going on with Ramondelli's sequential artwork, and it detracts from my understanding of the story. This is, I'm sure others would agree, a potential obstacle to enjoying a comic book, to each their own, of course. Thank you, Mark. Gene Hendrick says, so, if someone provides you with a copy of a treasury, you'll read it and cover it with them on the show? You know I happen to have a PDF of the Star Trek Motion Picture Super Special. Well, Gene, I have to say, that is not a treasury. That was a black and white, well, not black and white, that was a Marvel magazine. So until we do a show on the Marvel or the magazine format, which is, again, something else I would love to do if I had the time to, I would cover it there. But it's not a treasury, Gene. I'm sorry. So no, it is not going to be covered on this show. Sorry. My pal Chris Franklin, of course, from this network, says, regarding to me reading a Transformers comic, our little Rob is growing up. Fun episode, fellas. My Transformers knowledge is mostly confined to the G1 cartoon, the US version. So while I know most of these characters, situations are entirely new to me. Nice to see most of the original series Autobots didn't end up as cannon fodder as they did in the movie, which I love. I would actually be interested in learning more about these two offshoot series. All right, Chris, well, got your work cut out for you. Captain Entropy says, I haven't followed Transformers since the 80s and haven't seen the movie, if we mean the animated one, so this is probably a preschooler's epiphany to you all. Orion equals the Hunter. Pax equals peace. Orion Pax equals Seeker of Peace. Despite my noobishness, nubidity, this episode was fun. Well, thank you, Captain. And then Ryan Daly, of course, from Mar Network, says, in recent months, I've appeared on the Transformers Chronicles, part of the Longbox Crusade podcast, as well as the Rod Pod, which covers this era of IDW Transformers comics, so I've told this story before. Derek alluded to my feelings about this era, and he pretty much got it right. The thing about the Transformers that I loved as a child is that they were robots who changed into cars and trucks and guns and cassette tapes, all the things that I could see in the real world. I connected with the robots in disguise aspect, and thus, my preferred setting for Transformers stories is on Earth, where Optimus Prime and Ironhide and the rest have to interact with humankind. This was the basis of the original cartoon and comic series, This Is What I Like. But the longer the property went, the more they got away from that. The stories jumped into the future and frequently left Earth, so they ought Autobots and Decepticons changed into futuristic alien cars that I had no feeling for. And I totally understand why Derek and others prefer these later eras, because the storytelling is usually a lot better. The third season of the original animated series that came out after the movie is written much, much better than seasons 1 and 2, but I didn't like it as much because the setting and the Transformers were so different, they had left me behind. The analogy I would draw is imagine your favorite writer and favorite artist teamed up to tell the definitive Aquaman story. It gets a huge push from DC editorial and marketing, it has widespread mainstream appeal. Except it's not Arthur Curry. It's a different guy calling himself Aquaman, and it's set 1,000 years ago. Maybe it'll be really good, but is it what you wanted? Yeah, Ryan, there's a lot of validity to that argument. You used an analogy that obviously hits me where I live, and I think most of us have that example somewhere of some version of a character. It's like, yeah, it's good, but is it the thing I wanted? So, yeah, it's a good point. And then Ido Bosnar comes back with a second comment, and he says, man, what a week. Finally found a time today to listen to this episode. First, I have to say I have almost zero interest in and almost that little knowledge of the Transformers. I was already well into my teens and well beyond caring when the toys and the accompanying cartoons and comics came out. As to the movies, I saw the last part of one of the Explodey Bay films on TV a few years ago and thought it was pretty sucky, but then quite recently watched Bumblebee and rather liked it. So I was a blank slate coming into this, and I really enjoyed the conversation. I found it very informative. I doubt it will make me investigate further into the whole Transformers franchise, but it's nice to learn something about such a major pop culture property. So thanks to both Rob and Derek. And, by the way, aren't they all imaginary stories? Yes, yes, they are, Ido. Yeah, and again, I as I said on the show, I don't think that I'm going to really go back into read Transformers comics. Maybe I would dip into some of the Marvel ones because they're probably a little more my speed just in terms of like that's kind of my era, at least the 70s and 80s. But I nevertheless enjoyed reading the book, and I did, as I said, I liked that one story a lot, and I appreciated Derek coming on to the show to sort of inform me about Transformers. And I feel I'm still going to make jokes about them being boxes and stuff just because I love repeating a joke way past to the point where it's funny anymore. But nevertheless, I'm glad that I have a greater appreciation for this property than I had before. And of course, and I always enjoy talking to Derek, period. So that was great that he came on. And so thanks everybody for leaving comments. Sean Corey, I have to say, you never came back and left me a comment letting me know whether you actually did listen to the show. So if you're listening to this, please let me know if you did come back and listen to this Transformers episode and what you thought of it. So again, thanks everybody for listening. And thanks so much for leaving comments. And of course, if you want to leave a comment, go to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And you can also leave a review on iTunes. We really appreciate that. The Treasure Kiss hasn't had a new review in a while, and I really would love to see one. So if you're so inclined, please leave us a 5-star review. And then finally, I have to thank everybody that retweeted the last episode when it came out on Twitter. That again helps get the show noticed. So big thanks to Oswald Liz, Supermates Pod, Ryan Daly 01, GB Blackrock, Once Upon a Geek, Firestorm Fan, It's Plastic Man, Max Romero, Sean 42AZ, Dr. Pop Culture BG, Siskoid, BTB Blog, BotTalk.com, Kyle Benning Art, Mountain Flower 1, Chris Leiden 7, Fanholes Podcast, Pulp to Pixel, and HOCOF, which is, of course, Derek William Crabb's History of Comics on Film series, which if you are not watching on YouTube, you should be because they are a total delight. So that's great. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Big thanks to Ryan Daly for stopping by and talking about Batman versus the Incredible Hulk, one of the great treasuries ever done. So that was a total blast to do. So that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And, of course, we now have a Fire and Water Podcast Patreon. So if you want to pledge to support the network and keep the lights on, you can go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And depending on what you pledge, you can unlock different awards. You can be mentioned on a show of your choice. So if you want to ever be mentioned on Treasury Cash, you can do that. And again, really, we appreciate all the help we could get to help keep the Fire and Water Podcast running. So once again, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And of course, we'll have that link in the show notes as well. So once again, thanks everybody for listening. And until the next episode, go big or go home.
This is the Hulk. You can place the Hulk into the rage cage. With a few pumps of the Hulk inflator, you can make the Hulk grow in size. Rip out of the shirt. And break out of the rage cage. The Hulk comes complete as shown. Some assembly required from Fun Stuff.